We bid you welcome. We bid you welcome who come with weary spirits seeking rest, who come with troubles that are too much with you, who come hurt and afraid. We bid you welcome who come with hope in your heart, who come with anticipation in your step, who come proud and joyous. We bid you welcome who are seekers of a new faith, who come to probe and explore, who come to learn. We bid you welcome who enter this hall as a homecoming, who have found here room for your spirit, who find in this people a family. Whoever you are, whatever you are, wherever you are on your journey, we bid you welcome. Good morning. My name is Kathleen Oldfather, and I'm the convener today. Got lots of people involved in the program today, so it's going to be a great program. I'd like to welcome visitors, and if you missed it on the way in, we have a visitor's book that you can sign and ask to receive the newsletter in the future. And I also invite everyone here to stay after and have coffee and snacks and get to know people. There are announcements provided in the bulletin today, so I encourage you to read those. And no one has given me any others, so we'll keep on going to the chalice lighting. And let Michael light the chalice. The struggle for freedom. We light this chalice in memory of the courage of those who have struggled for freedom, the persistence of those who have struggled for justice, and the love of those who have built beloved communities like this to carry on the light of hope. And I invite you all to join us in a hymn, and did so well last week on a round that we're going to try it again. And Michael Oldfather is going to lead the round with some assistance. The words of this are on the front of the program, if that's easier for you.
Wonder, worship, love, or love, we are.
Thank you. And keep those words in your mind because you're going to hear them again later in the program. Would the children like to come up and join Scott here, who's going to tell us a tale of two commons? Come on up, kids. Come on, come on.
Good morning, everyone. All right. Now, as everybody's coming up, I want to ask you, who knows what's going on tomorrow? Yeah? What is it? 4th of July. And what is that a celebration of? What are we celebrating on 4th of July, yeah? You forgot? Yeah? Okay. We're celebrating fireworks, yeah. That's one thing, absolutely. What else are we celebrating, yeah? Independence of the country, yeah. Today, tomorrow, yeah? What do you want to add to that? America's birthday, yeah? The 4th of July, yeah, it's all of those things, right? America's birthday, and we're celebrating independence. Now, the 4th of July is considered a very patriotic holiday. People feel very patriotic on this day. Who knows what it means to be patriotic? You have any idea? What does that mean, yeah? Loyal to our country. Yeah, so tomorrow is a patriotic holiday. But you know what? How did that independence, who did America get independence from? Yeah? What? The Pilgrims? They were one of the first people here, right? And they had left another country. Do you know what country they had left? England, that's right. And so England, Great Britain, was in charge of the colonies here. So when that happened, some people thought that the revolutionaries were not very patriotic. You know why? Because they weren't being loyal to their country, to the country that was in charge, Great Britain, right? So the revolutionaries were called, they were engaged in treason, being very unpatriotic. So one of the things that we're going to be talking about today, the adults are going to be talking about today, in fact, we are too, is we're going to be talking about what it means to be patriotic and loyal to a country and why. So I've got a short little story that's about not so much patriotism, but it's about rules. Because one of the things the revolutionaries were very upset at was certain kinds of rules. They were upset at certain rules. Great Britain, very far away, were making lots of rules, and they didn't like the rules that were getting made. So they wanted something different. So one of the things that's important to think about is what rules are good rules. All right, so here's a quick story. Once upon a time, long, long ago, not long, long ago, but sort of long ago, back when people didn't have cars and the only way to get around was with horses and stuff, there was a town, and it had an area called the Commons. Does anybody know what Commons is? Has anybody heard of anything like maybe a Boston Common? Has anybody been to Boston? We're going to be talking about Boston in the RE program too. Well, Commons is an area that's common for everybody to use. And what the Commons in this town was used for was a little extra grazing. If your livestock, you had animals, and they need to eat a little more grass than you had on your land, they could send them over to the common area, and they could graze a little extra and get a little, you know, change of pace, and then come back. All right, but it was for everybody. And everybody knew that if everybody sent all of their animals over to the commons and ate it, it wasn't that big, that the grass would be all gone. Everybody knew that. But everybody in this town, they wanted a little extra for their livestock. So they sent their animals over to the commons, and then the other neighbor sent his animals over to the commons, and then the other neighbor on that farm sent his animals over to the commons, and then everybody did that. And they kind of thought, well, yeah, you know what? The commons could get eaten all away, but I might as well take advantage of it while it's there. And so they all did that. And after a little while, there was no more grass in the commons, and none of the animals could eat it, anything there. Now, the next town over, they saw this happening, and they said, you know what? We have to make a rule. We have to make sure that people send their animals over to the commons just for a little bit, just to eat a little bit. And so they set up this rule. And the people in the town said, some of the people said, wait a second, we don't like this. I want to be able to send Send my animals over. We should all be able to use this whenever we want. It's a common area. I don't like you sending up these rules. I don't like these rules. But the rules meant that each person could only use the commons a little bit. And what do you think happened to those commons? That common area, yeah? They got eaten, but not too much. So grass kept on growing and growing and growing. And that common area was kept on being able to be used for everybody because there was a rule in place to make sure that it was going to be used by everybody. All right, so now what does this have to do with patriotism? There were these two different towns, two commons. One of them, everybody got to do whatever they wanted, and the grass all went away. And the other one, there was a rule imposed, and the grass stayed. The tale of the two commons, we're going to talk about this more back in RE, so everybody, the adults, can know this is the kind of thing we're going to be talking about in the RE room, is what's called the social contract, heady stuff for kids, but Unitarians can handle it. So what we're going to be talking about is about what rules are good rules. Right. So the patriots, the revolutionaries that started this country, the rules that were being imposed, they thought they were not good rules because they weren't for the good for everybody, and they did not help everybody out. They were not rules that were good for them. They were rules that were just good for the king. But a rule about the commons saying, hey, everybody can only eat a little bit, is a rule that's good for everybody. So it's being patriotic sometimes means being loyal to your country when it's employing good rules, but maybe it means saying when the bad rules are bad, too. And that's part of what's going to be talked about today in this, and for the adults, too. Okay? So that's what I got to tell you today. We'll send off. We'll go off now.
We'll take some time to share joys and sorrows. And I want to start out with a joy today, and that's to welcome several new members who have signed the membership book since about the end of May. Normally we will have a membership recognition, but since we have so many that have joined recently, we thought we'd just introduce them. And if you're here, stand up until we list everybody, and then people will know that you're a new member and they can introduce themselves later. Amy Fowler, I don't think she's here today, but Amy attended as a child and then joined as an adult, so that's neat. Katie and Ryan Meyer, Amber and Drew Benham, well, there they are. Stay standing, and Deirdre Greeley. So welcome. And if you have been wanting to join the fellowship but haven't done it, then you need to talk to Shirley Holbrook, who's here today, or me, and we'll get the membership book out. Okay, other joys and concerns or other joys and sorrows that you would like to share today? Or if you're visiting and it's a joy to you, feel free to say something.
I'm Stephen Mull, and I read in the paper this morning, actually Mom read to me while I was driving, I have a joy and a concern. It seems that the ExxonMobil pipeline under the Yellowstone River ruptured and left a 20-mile plume of oil down the river, fouling both sides, which is a concern. But the joy is they're still very profitable.
I'm Stacy Brofman. And my joy this morning is that the little girl that I get to work with all the time, Aaliyah, is here visiting with us today, and I get to have her for the whole holiday weekend to give her newly adopted mother a chance to just have a little break and no kids. So thanks.
Anna Franklin, I I'm joyful because I just 2 days ago received a 50% off scholarship to go to Yoga Therapy Symposium in California in September. So,
my name is Melissa McKee. As many of you know, I'm a type 1 diabetic, and I have been struggling with my current insulin. It may be that in this heat, it is not stable enough, and this is why I'm having trouble keeping control of my blood sugar. There is another insulin that is more stable in hot heat, but I've never used it, and it works differently than this insulin I've been using for 17 years. And I'm a little concerned about possibly having to switch. I want an insulin that works, but I don't know how this other stuff works, and it's the change is a little terrifying. So, you know, positive thoughts.
Are there any others? Well, someone has to announce that it's a joy to have Aaron here back with us. And we also have Danny and her sons, Quinn and Logan, are back visiting. Am I missing anybody else? Okay, Gene's got one.
Gene Severs. My joy is that my world traveler, younger daughter Michaela, is back safe, as are the rest. The director said that up to this point, all of the members have returned, or at least the same number have returned every year. So that held for this year as well.
Okay. Here's a reading then by retired UU minister Robert Walsh. And tells us that nothing is settled. Everything matters. It's called It Matters. I knew a man who had printed on his stationery this proverb: nothing is settled, everything matters. I remember him and his proverb sometimes, especially when it seems impossible to change the world or myself in any significant way. I say it's not true that nothing is settled. In the past year, choices have been made, losses have been suffered, there have been growth and decay, and there's been commitments and betrayals. None of that can be undone. A year ago, no one would have known whether one person would become pregnant, whether another would get cancer, another would take a new job, have to move, another would have an accident. But now it is settled. One day this year, I was present just when someone needed me. Another day, I was busy doing something else when I was needed. One day, I said something stupid to a friend and injured our relationship. Another day, I said something that enabled a person to see life in a new way. The best and worst of those days are now written. All my tears of joy and sorrow cannot erase it. Well, if I stay with this meditation long enough, the reply from my friend comes: you have misunderstood the proverb. It is true that you cannot escape the consequences of your actions or the chances of the world. But what is not settled is how the story turns out. What is not settled is what the meaning of your life will be. The meaning of a life is not contained within one act or one day or one year. As long as you are alive, the story of your life is still being told, and the meaning is still open. As long as there is life in the world, the story of the world is still being told. What is done, but nothing is settled. And if nothing is settled, then everything matters. Every choice, every act this year matters. Every word, every deed is making the meaning of your life and telling the story of the world. Everything matters in the year coming, and more importantly, everything matters today. And we'll listen to Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. He wrote this in response to the U.S. entry into World War II. In 1942, he wrote it. Today's program focuses on patriotism, as you heard from Scott. And I want to say that Scott Tonona first conceived of this program idea, and he did much or most of the organization of it. Since he is with the World Travelers today, traveling to Boston, he asked me to convene. I wanted to just let you know that Scott's more expanded theme is that patriotism could be thought of as a sort of a covenant to make the country as good as it can be for the sake of its citizens and other people in the world affected by it. So how do we live out this covenant, pledge, or promise to make the country and the world better? Sometimes we live it through allegiance, sometimes through civil disobedience. And the author of the reading that I read might remind us that nothing is settled and that everything matters still. So now I'm going to turn this program over to our three speakers who will read excerpts from UU sermons and then make their own comments. And first, it's going to be Blake Bellinger, and then Stacy Broffman, and last, Dick Beeman. And if there's time, we'll have some discussion. Okay, Blake.
I'm going to start with a reading from the Tao Te Ching by Lao Tzu, chapter 18. When the great way is forgotten, goodness and piety appear. When the body's intelligence declines, cleverness and knowledge step forth. When there is no peace in the family, filial piety begins. When the country falls into chaos, patriotism is born. This reading is from Robert Mayerson, and it is called Patriotism. In the 2008 election, the American flag was ever present in both campaigns, apparently to remind us of the candidate's patriotism. The more flags showing, the better, and heaven help the candidate who failed to wear the American flag pin on his or her lapel. Never mind that the pin was in all likelihood fabricated in an overseas sweatshop, along with the yellow decal ribbons proclaiming support for the troops. I guess the theory was that without the symbol, one couldn't be sure that the candidate was truly patriotic. Personal memories for me of the Vietnam era America, love it or leave it bumper stickers. The notion that patriotism consists of paying homage to symbols isn't new. Governments have made that type of appeal throughout history. The Nazi movement in 1930s Germany was fueled by symbolism, stirring music, displays of uniformed men and military hardware, impressive, and a trigger to mob mentality. I think a person's interpretation of the word patriotism tells much about the person's views and era. Pro-slavery was once patriotic. Pro-labor union was un-American. It seems that there are those who still believe that one. Today, being for marriage equality is looked upon by some as godless and unpatriotic. Marginalizing people who hold minority or no religious views by some is considered patriotic. The list is endless. Some in the media, public office, and other questionable sources tell us that one's degree of patriotism is governed by the degree to which they believe our country is the only repository of good in the world. Patriotism wears many disguises in America. So, how do we define patriotism? The simple, my country, right or wrong, brand is easy, as are all simplistic answers. I believe civil disobedience is a more complex form of patriotism. How many laws did Martin Luther King Jr. break to further the cause of justice? Respecting unpopular points of view is patriotic. Threatening those views is not. Would wearing a flag pin make me patriotic? Or does believing in what the flag was meant to represent? So many of us use that flag pin as a litmus test, seem to feel that when I voice opposition to policies I believe are wrong, I am being unpatriotic. What would Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Thomas Paine do? Well, we know what they did when they tired of paying homage to an unresponsive government. I think most of us would agree that Jefferson was an American patriot, yet Jefferson opined that it was right that it was his right, no, the responsibility of the citizenry to monitor the actions of our government and, when necessary, remove the government. Would Jefferson be thought of as a traitor by today's standards? I imagine a 1776 version of Fox News getting daily talking points from the King of England and spouting the premise that questioning and civil disobedience were unpatriotic and treasonous. I'd love to be considered a patriot, if only I could believe that my country always did the right thing, if only I trusted our leaders to uphold constitutional rights, if I could believe that the lack of concern shown while New Orleans was drowning had nothing to do with a disregard for poor and powerless people, and if I could believe our leaders went to war as a last resort, I might be considered patriotic. But I can't do those things. If I did, I wouldn't be patriotic. It would be an insult to the founding principles of America and paying homage to the symbols of America while trashing the idealism upon which it was founded. And it would be dishonest. Patriotism is probably a good thing, but maybe a sharper definition would help. Here are a few thoughts. I'm certain you can add your own. Believing my country can lead the world towards peace is more patriotic than knowing we can vanquish anyone in war. I think the many thousands of citizens who took to the streets prior to the invasion of Iraq were patriots in the true spirit of our founders. It is patriotic to recognize and honor the separation of religious belief from the governing of our country. Keep in mind how many came to America to escape regimes where the line between government and religion were blurred or simply ignored. The rights of the minority must never be compromised by the will of the majority. To do otherwise is unpatriotic and anathema to the Constitution. I believe torture is un-American and is the de facto repeal of the right of habeas corpus, and that this nation was founded on the premise that it be ruled by laws and not by men. George Washington was offered the position of king. His wise refusal was a lesson. We do not benefit by mimicking that which we despise. And yet we hear constantly that, well, they do it, so why shouldn't we do it? As a patriot, we would say that by mimicking that which with we disagree is surrendering. We do not spread democracy by ignoring democratic ideals. When we become what we purport to fight against, we are committing treason. And that treason is no less so when our leaders do it. And when we send our children off to fight and die in wars of choice, it may be hubris or empire building or material gain, but it is not patriotism. Will history judge those who speak out against war as traitors or as patriots? What of those in support of the right of every loving couple to be married? Blasphemous? Is it patriotic, too, as many of the right have already begun, to be calling for a failure of a president, even before he's taken office? It is antithetical to both democracy and religion. I cannot believe in that. So this reading got me thinking. And I think the author here, Robert Mayerson, he is calling for a patriotism, or he is calling for us to be aware of patriotism as an instrument and as a lever of persuasion. He argues instead for a critical patriotism, and that we must be willing and ready to question calls to patriotism, as well as speak out against it. We should be suspicious of calls such as, you are either with us or you're against us, and recognize that these calls can in fact be polarizing and highly unpatriotic. And I see this as this type of criticality as absolutely necessary to be an engaged citizenry and to be patriotic. At the core of this reading, I think there is a very important question. How can I be patriotic to a republic that sometimes takes actions that are inconsistent with my values. I don't have an answer to that, but it did remind me of a recent conversation I had with Indigo, our 8-year-old daughter, about the Pledge of Allegiance. And it was interesting to me that she can recite the Pledge of Allegiance perfectly with her class every day. And when I asked her what it means, she really had no idea. And it seemed true that was true of her peers at school as well. And so we took some time to dissect the Pledge of Allegiance and talk about what the words mean individually, as well as what the words mean collectively. And I'm not going to go through all of that this morning, but I think there's an important point that I learned something important through that discussion with her. And I'm going to read the first part of the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands. So we all know that pledge is a solemn promise or undertaking, and allegiance is loyalty or commitment to an individual or of an individual to a group or a cause. So pledging allegiance to a flag and a republic, especially for an 8-year-old, requires a fair amount of interpretation and abstraction. It also requires of us who know what this means a commitment to a group that doesn't always act in ways that we are supportive of. So for me, this is problematic. Alternatively, we might consider a slightly different pledge, one that allows us to be consistent with our beliefs. And I don't know exactly what this pledge is, but I'm inspired by the final sentence of the Declaration of Independence. And for the support of this declaration, we, the representatives of the United States of America, mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Here they're making a pledge to one another, much less abstract, potentially much more sincere, and much more meaningful. And so tomorrow, on Independence Day, I, for one, will celebrate patriotism with a pledge not to a flag or a republic, but to my neighbors, friends, and Americans broadly. A pledge to contribute to make my nation a place more aligned with my values and a place in which I am proud to be a patriot.
The words to our opening hymn, Come, Come, Whoever You Are, are from a poem by the 13th century Sufi mystic Jalaluddin Rumi. There are many adaptations of the poem, but most of them omit a line. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving. Ours is no caravan of despair. Though you have broken your vows 1,000 times, come, yet again come. The line that is so often omitted, though you have broken your vows 1,000 times, is such an important line. It points out that we are not only ones who break our vows. We need to know that imperfection is a part of the human condition, that we can fail and fail again, and still we are welcome. When I was asked to do a reading for this service, I thought, that's no problem. You know, Scott's going to give me something to read. I'll just read it verbatim, you know. It'll be over quickly and painlessly, but I should have known that nothing is that simple. I was given the sermon on not throwing anything away that was written by UU minister Melissa Zimmer Carville and was delivered in 2003. It's a very personal piece, and it focuses on human imperfections and acceptance. It also focuses on the ideal that we are born into a covenant with life, that even our faults are part of us and not to be thrown away. I thought, you know, I can do this. But then Scott threw a wrench into the works and added in the email that in some way this was all to tie into a patriotic theme, loyalty to our country, and perhaps the possibility of civil disobedience as a form of patriotism. Thank you very much, Scott. I had planned to read the canned speech and then throw in a few lines of personal commentary following the focus of the sermon's author, but then I read Wednesday's paper. The reference to our opening hymn that is from that author is about the extent of my usage of that original sermon. I feel too strongly about our city's current state of affairs to stay with the original piece. In my not so humble opinion, I feel that as a resident of the city of Manhattan, that as a taxpayer and as a productive member of its society, that I participate in a covenant or a promise of sorts that as I take care of the city will in turn take care of me. I am as well deeply embedded with the ideal that charity begins at home and that the able should take care of the less able. In other words, that a covenant includes responsibilities due to one another. Rebecca Parker, UU minister, wrote that the word covenant means to come together by making a promise. We inherit covenant before we create it, and for reasons we cannot comprehend, we were given the gift of life. That gift was free, a result of life's longing for itself. Ms. Parker continues with, but having been given this gift, we are asked to give in return. We are asked to use our lives to do something lovely and generous and wonderful with them that we might be a blessing. We are born into covenant through some great gift. We live out that covenant through our relationships with ourselves, other people, animals, the natural world, through our relationship with that which called us into being. But for myself, reading Wednesday's paper brought me crashing into the reality that not all people share that similar sentiment to include some of our so-called elected leaders. To illustrate, when asked to comment regarding the possibility of cutting funding to social service agencies by the city, Commissioner Mata responded in the Mercury with this, "They're great agencies of people that do great work, but I do have issues with using city funds to give to these." He goes on to say that those compassionate people in the community have the option to volunteer and donate to social service programs. I wonder if he'll be one of those supposed compassionates. He also said that social services are getting away from the core services of the city government, such as infrastructure and public safety. But I ask, what could be more of a core service than taking care of the residents of Manhattan themselves? There is nothing more important to a community than its people, for they are the community itself. I wonder what the wanderer of the opening hymn would think if given the facts first. Would the community welcome wagon bring not only coupons in the local of Chamber of Commerce literature, but also toss in a list of services that will not be available should crisis occur? Perhaps a disclaimer in very small print that says, "We are happy to collect your tax money, but don't expect us to help any of the charitable organizations that may wish to assist you in your times of need." I offer that people are frequently broken in many ways. To toss them away with the assumption that another will, of course, step up to care for them is cruelty at best. I have with me today a special guest who illustrates better than any words I could ever write of the possible outcomes that can occur when interventions are taken in an assumed broken scenario. Faced with a new job and working in a new environment, I had the joy of meeting this little girl. To say she lived in poor circumstances is at best a gross misunderstatement. The family was plagued with drug addiction, denial, mental health issues, and poverty. In essence, they were incapable of providing the environment needed to help this child thrive. It would have been easy to sit back and wait for somebody else to take action, but I found I could not accept her intolerable conditions. Reporting these conditions was a terrifying action, and I faced scrutiny and an attempt at retaliation by the family. My medical ethics were questioned by a family that was faced with losing the only source of financial support that they had. That financial support was this child's meager disability check. After many hours of worry and work, I can thankfully report that this child has gone from a baby with the prognosis of only a 2-year lifespan to a young lady of almost 4 years old. From the child that was not allowed to wear clothes to the child who gets to pick out the colors in the outfit she's going to wear every day. And from the child who was left to lie on a couch in front of a TV 24 hours a day to this amazing individual who gets to charm you here today in this fellowship. Were these outcomes fiscally helpful to the local city and county? Absolutely. By providing early medical intervention, Tens of thousands of dollars have been saved by preventing medical complications, thus preventing hospitalization. But most of all, the quality of life that has been achieved and the love that has been shared is priceless. I went on to think, of course, angered and sad about the directions that are being taken in my own hometown, as well as the sad state of the nation, that it is our city that is also broken. I have often thought about leaving Manhattan to find greener, more liberal pastures. Oh, the joy of residing in a progressive town where there are not nearly as many cracks and breaks in the system, and to live where others have already done the work to build a better society. To reside alongside others that feel social justice is not an ideal but an achievable reality, and to know that all humankind is worth personal investment would be to me a utopia. But do I, however, throw away my life in Manhattan as a solution to an ugly problem? It made me think about how once my mother sent me a lovely and fragile gift. I was holding it and I was looking at it, and it didn't have a lot of monetary value, but to me, it was beautiful, and it was from my mom. My daughter asked me if she could hold it for a moment, and when she did, she dropped it and it smashed into a bunch of pieces. Yeah, it was her right there. She didn't mean to harm it, but she had a different approach to holding it than I did. When I recovered from the shock of the situation, I sat for hours, gluing the pieces back together. There were a couple of places that didn't fit exactly right, but it was again functional and whole and beautiful. I didn't sit and look at the broken mess and yell at my daughter. It meant something to me to see it whole again, and I spent the time to fix it. I see our city in the same context as that broken treasure. I just can't bring myself to sweep up the pieces of our system and then place them in the trash. I feel a moral and civic duty to try to make a difference, to glue back the pieces, to make it once again whole and functional. Our city commission has dropped our object of beauty and has lost some of the tiny pieces that made it what it was and what it was becoming. But it is up to us to re-glue, to repair, to not toss out what is broken. We need to communicate in loud and boisterous voices the needs and ideals of the citizens of our city. As in the case with my wonderful little friend here, I need to not sit and complain about the state of the nation, waiting for someone else to take a stand, but to stand up myself and shout. I close with a portion of an article written by John H. Schar titled "The Case for Patriotism." He writes, "Abraham Lincoln, the supreme authority on this subject, thought there was a patriotism unique to America. Americans, a motley gathering of various races and cultures, were bonded together not by blood or religion, not by tradition or territory, not by the calls and traditions of a city, but by a political idea. We are a nation formed by a covenant, by a dedication to a set of principles, and by an exchange of promises to uphold and advance certain commitments among ourselves and throughout the world. Those principles and commitments are the core of American identity, the soul of the body politic. They make the American nation unique and uniquely valuable among and to the other nations. But on the other side of this conception contains a warning very like the warning spoken by the prophets to Israel. If we fail in our promises to each other and lose the principles of the covenant, then we lose everything, for they are we."
My portion is entitled "Reimagining the American Dream," and for this portion, Scott Tenona asked me to read from a sermon entitled "Reimagining the American Dream" by Marilyn Sewell, who's a Unitarian minister emerita of the church in Portland, Oregon, but I'm personally not capable of reading a stanza from Shakespeare without subjecting it to a major edit and rewrite, so Marilyn Sewell stands little chance of being quoted accurately. What I've done is I've taken a few ideas from her sermon, mixed in some related ideas from another sermon that I found entitled The Myth of the American Dream by the Reverend Tim Kutzmark of the Unitarian Church in Reading, Massachusetts. And for fun, I've thrown in a little side riff on witchcraft in colonial America, which probably has nothing to do with the topic, but I'll try to get back on topic. In Marilyn Sewell's sermon, she describes how the American dream of freedom, democracy, and equal opportunity, as expressed in the Declaration of Independence, got off track. And she asks, what has happened to that noble experiment, to the country that was supposed to be as a city upon a hill, leading other nations to righteousness and to justice? We have become a nation where freedom is now interpreted to mean that the strong don't have to care for the weak. We are a nation that stinks from corruption at the top, a nation that wraps itself in the language of Christianity while pandering unashamedly to the rich and ignoring the poor. We are a nation hated and reviled by many other nations and grudgingly tolerated by those who should count us as friends. We are very far from that city upon a hill, that moral compass for other nations. Rather, we have decided to build an empire so that a few might flourish at the expense of the many. Rough, unquote. You heard reference in that quote to the city upon the hill, which is an image of America and of the American dream that has been used in recent years by politicians, most notably Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, and also by John F. Kennedy just before he took office as president, newly elected. But the first use of the image of America as a shining city on a hill was by John Winthrop in 1630 on a ship having just crossed the Atlantic, not yet disembarked. In a speech he gave to a group of Puritans at the threshold of the New World, about to become the Massachusetts Bay colonists, attempting to escape religious intolerance and persecution in England. John Winthrop was a Puritan. He was the first governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. He was the founder of Boston, which, of course, as we know, is the headquarters of the Unitarian Universalist Association. And in using that image of the city on the hill as a goal for the American dream, John Winthrop was himself merely recasting the words of Jesus in his Sermon on the Mount in the Gospel of Matthew. And Jesus is reputed to have said, rough quote, paraphrased, "You are the light of the world." And he was talking to his disciples at the time, and he was encouraging them to spread the gospel of truth and light through both their words and their deeds. He said, "You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. People don't light a lamp, then hide it under a bowl. Rather, they put it on a stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before humanity so that they may see your good deeds," unquote. Okay, now getting back to John Winthrop and his 400 Puritan colonists who were about to disembark at the future site of Boston, and also regarding the American dream that he alluded to in his speech to the Puritans, and again going back and sort of quoting Marilyn Sewell, who spoke about John Winthrop. That dream included freedom to worship as they wished. It included the opportunity to prosper if they were willing to work hard. It included the possibility of owning their own land, plowing their own fields, not being the landless servants or serfs they would have been in the old country, where the class systems were rigidly enforced, where your life was absolutely locked into place by your rank and your birth order. Although this dream promised much to the individual, it was also a dream grounded in holy covenant with God and with one another. John Winthrop said in his speech, quote, "We are entered into covenant with God for this work. We have taken out a commission." And by that, I think he meant the commission that he had from the King of England to develop the Massachusetts Bay Colony. "We have taken out a commission. We must be knit together in this work as one man. We must entertain each other in brotherly affection. We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of our fellow man's necessities." I love that phrase. I got to say it again. "We must be willing to abridge ourselves of our superfluities for the supply of our fellow man's necessities. For we must consider that we shall be as a city on a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us," unquote. That was a statement of manifest destiny. We shall be a shining example to the rest of the world, a moral light that will guide others into ways of mercy and justice. Now, granted, John Winthrop's vision of the city on the hill was not in precise accord with what, let's say, John F. Kennedy's vision was, or even with Reagan's naive, paternalistic, anti-government, anti-social safety net vision was when he cited the same idea. And not all people fell under the purview of the dream in John Winthrop's time. Certainly women did not, slaves did not, men who did not own property did not. Of course, Governor Winthrop, like most colonists, supported slavery, supported the second-class status of women, supported the theft of Native American lands, and considered the concept of universal democracy not merely ill-advised, but actually abhorrent, instead believing that civil rights and voting rights were properly restricted only to men and only to a privileged class of religiously qualified men. So even though he was fleeing religious intolerance, he was busily working on his own brand of religious intolerance. And he at least initially opposed the idea of extending voting rights to all free men, instead favoring restricting the rights to free men who had formerly been admitted into the local churches, into the properly authorized churches. Regarding the theft of native lands, John Winthrop, of course, like most colonists, did not consider it theft and rationalized that Native Americans did not even have a concept of land ownership, and there's an element of truth in that, did not even have a concept of land ownership equivalent to that of the so-called civilized races, and that in any case, the rights of the civilized races superseded those of the primitives. John Winthrop lived during a time when witchcraft was an offense punishable by execution. And he mentions this in his personal journal. He mentions the first recorded execution of a witch in America, and the only evidence that was required at that time for a conviction of witchcraft was the testimony of anybody, any one person. The first witch executed in America was Alice Young. Alice Young was hanged in Hartford, Connecticut in 1647, more than 40 years before the Salem witch hysteria of 1692 in neighboring Massachusetts. Luckily for me, Alice Young was hanged after giving birth, and I say that because she was my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. That was nine greats. Now, it's true that I have 1,023 other great times nine grandmother, but she's the coolest by far. There are probably 50,000 other Americans living today who could make the same statement, which just shows how related we all are. Also, bear in mind that at the time, 1630, in North America, the total population, excluding Native Americans, was only about 5,000, including Europeans and African Americans. But I digress. We were talking about the American dream. How it has changed, whether or not we are losing sight of it. If the American dream is being hobbled, and if the economy is sputtering, is it because the rich are taxed too highly to foster growth-enabling, job-creating investment? Is it because we squander too much of the national wealth perpetuating dependence on federal handouts and discouraging initiative by supporting welfare queens and superfluous activities like arts education, basic scientific research, support of the poor? By the way, the term welfare queen was coined by Ronald Reagan, presumably while he was strategizing on how to eliminate impediments to his vision of a shining city on the hill. And as another minor aside, those poor scapegoats were rechristened teenage immigrant welfare mothers on drugs with tongue-in-cheek by the left-wing musician, comedian, and commentator Dave Lippmann. Check him out sometime. But I digress again. Now, here is a paraphrase of what the Reverend Tim Kutzmark says in his sermon, The Myth of the American Dream, and he in turn incorporates some of the ideas of Howard Zinn, Barbara Ehrenreich, and others, and I won't try to separate his quotes within quotes. I'll just tell you roughly what he said in his sermon. America has the greatest disparity between rich and poor of any modern nation. The typical CEO of a Fortune 500 company needs only 15 minutes to make what the average worker in his company earns in a week. What can we do as Unitarian Universalist people of faith to challenge the savage inequalities of American life? We can do more than merely write checks to charity. I don't mean to belittle the important work of putting Band-Aids on the needy, but what is more essential is working to alter the system that perpetuates the need for us to be charitable in the first place. What can we do? We can fight for increasing social benefits, universal health insurance, universal child care subsidy. We can demand that cities build affordable housing rather than demolishing it or gentrifying it. We can demand that the justice system vigorously implement laws that prohibit firing people for union activity. We can join the living wage movement, which is using whatever leverage it has to convince individual cities to raise wages. Revolutionary change does not come as one cataclysmic moment, but as an endless succession of surprises moving zigzag towards a more decent society. Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can quietly become a power no government can suppress. I dream of us being a congregation of change makers. I dream of us being a congregation of conscience. I dream of us being a congregation stirred to action. I believe that a moral revolution for the worth and dignity of all people can begin in churches like ours. I believe that a moral revolution for a just economic community can begin with our hands, our hearts, and our heads. I believe that it is our religious imperative to recast and reshape the American dream. May it be so.
Thank you very much to the three speakers today. I know they spent a lot of time with those sermons and developing their thoughts for this today. We have about 5 minutes if you would like to make a comment or ask a question of one of the speakers. And the hands are up already. I saw Mike's first and then Sybil's. So.
Hi, I'm Mike Bonella. I'd just like to thank all of our speakers today, and I would also like to say that I would love to see some of you speak at a city commission meeting and give renditions of what you just said.
I think the mic went out here. Well, we have a lot of people who are using headphones, so that's the problem with that. And come up here, I guess, in the meantime. But he's so quick, he's about got it done. I'd like to thank Doug, the sound man, today. The sound people never get thanked, and they do such a big, important job every week in helping us with mics and recording the program. So,
thank you. I have so many thoughts right now. I'm going to try to keep it really short. But, you know, I was at a city commission meeting, and I remember recently telling my wife, you know, there's not much point in going down there. They have their agendas. It's how they got elected. It was on these platforms of doing all these terrible things. And I'm sad to say that I was right. But I'm also sad to say that I try to discourage anyone from going down there and speaking, you know, reason. What's going on in the city right now is disturbing, and I would like to encourage more of you to speak at the city commission meetings, make your thoughts known. You all speak so eloquently, and I don't feel that I really do, and so I'm not the best person to go down there, but I do it anyway. I went to a meeting recently after hearing the Chamber of Commerce take the position of doing away with the discrimination ordinance. I could not sit in my chair and not go down and say that they do not represent all business owners. They've done some horrible things as a group, and I could not keep my mouth shut for that reason. I think we all need to make strong arguments to our present city commissioners, and I really hope that some of you who speak so well are feeling that desire to go down and talk also.
Sybil Perkins, I want to thank all the speakers, but especially Stacy. You took a long time with your own words and really echoed how, you know, I'm feeling. You know, I've said to my husband, I'm not sure if I can live in this community. It's so discouraging. And I tend to be pretty naive as far as thinking that things will work out for the best and people have big hearts and the best thing will happen. But I was told recently by someone very in the know that said once an issue comes before the city council, the decision's already been made. It all happens before the meeting. And I was shocked by that, but I guess it's a good piece of information. I'm on the board of the Manhattan Community Gardens, and Howie's has told us that he intends to buy half of the gardens. And that's happened before, and people in the gardens aren't real encouraged that we can stop that, given this city commission. And once that's gone, that's gone. You know, by the way, the Manhattan Community Gardens are the oldest community gardens in the state and possibly in the country, and has won state and national and international awards. So it's very disturbing that it's going to be bought for $45,000 to park garbage trucks on. But anyway, I don't want to monopolize, but I will keep everybody informed of that, and hopefully we can speak as a group for the gardens too. And I want to encourage Stacy to run for city commission.
There you go.
Ann Cowan, I also thank all the speakers this morning. They spoke out so strongly. And so if this fellowship believes what we've been hearing this morning, our UUFM Social Action Committee should be very strong and active and lively. And this year, Stacy is the chair of that committee. And there is a meeting coming up on the 13th, a Wednesday, at 5:30 here, where we should be expanding our voice in the community, and through our Social Action Committee and Stacy's leadership, we can do that.
Okay, there's several hands, so keep it very brief so we can get a few more in.
I'm Ruth Friedman. As discouraged as we are about Manhattan, I fear that it isn't just Manhattan. The refusal of Congress to raise the taxes of the wealthy is behind much of the thinking in the country. And I heard a congressman this morning say they're not concerned with the people, they're just concerned with politics, which means themselves.
There's Marilyn. Michael, do you still have a comment? Or no? Okay.
Like Dick, my ancestors also came very soon after the Mayflower. And one of my old ancestors wanted to remind people at the time the Constitution was written that the people who are elected are public servants, not public bosses. And we will have to remind the people and the city commission that they are servants of the public. And the public has to speak, and they should listen. We'll have to remind them of that constantly.
Okay, well, we have a closing hymn and then a few closing words. Hymn number 159, This Is My Song.
Thank you.
can stay standing if you want. There are miles behind you. There are miles behind you and many more ahead. As you journey on toward wholeness, may all that is good and true guide your way. May the joy of love lighten every step, and the miracle that is life be ever in your sight. So be it.